And so I think this is something that the Biden team hasn't done well at, the Trump team didn't do well at. We haven't really explained to the American people why they should care about Taiwan.
Hello and welcome back to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs, the entirely student-run podcast at Johns Hopkins University. My name is Julia Ahn, and I'm joined today by my co-host, Chris Park. Since the passage of the Taiwan Relations Act of 1979, the U.S. government has maintained a special, unofficial relationship with Taiwan, pursuing a policy of strategic ambiguity with regards to how it would respond to a Chinese attack. China's posture towards Taiwan, however, has become increasingly aggressive, responding in August to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit by encircling the island with military exercises for several days. In this episode, we discuss the future of strategic ambiguity towards Taiwan and whether the U.S. should maintain such a policy with China's increasing assertiveness. We then examine what Chinese predation could look like, either an outright attack or tactics that lie in the gray zone, and how the U.S. can continue to deter and prepare for conflict with China over Taiwan. Joining us today on the podcast is Dr. Zach Cooper. Zach Cooper is senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he studies U.S. strategy in Asia. He also co-directs the Alliance for Securing Democracy and teaches at Princeton University. In the past, he has worked at the National Security Council and the Department of Defense. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. Dr. Cooper, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Of course, really happy to be here.
So China has pledged multiple times to unify Taiwan. And just to situate our listeners at the start of the podcast, what is the historical context exactly between the China-Taiwan relationship? And why is it so important to China to unify Taiwan with the mainland?
Well, if you go back to the long history of U.S.-China relations, it turns out that especially from 1949 through the 1970s, actually, when the U.S. Was thinking about China, it still called the Republic of China the sort of rightful government of China, right? So from 1949, when Chiang Kai-shek and his nationalist group loses the war with the communists, is forced to flee to Taiwan, until 1979, the U.S. still formally recognizes the Republic of China as the rightful government of all of China. And that only changes in the 1970s. And, you know, I think for many in Beijing, the problem, the deep roots of the U.S.-China tensions at the moment go back, therefore, to really that 1949 period. And there's a feeling that at the end of the day, it was really the United States that prevented the Communist Party from finally eliminating the nationalists on Taiwan. And it did so, in fact, by establishing mutual defense treaty with Taiwan. And so that's part of what makes this so difficult, is that the roots go back, you know, for decades and decades, but also that the agreements that we made in the 1970s to try and manage this relationship were incredibly murky, in part because we could never really agree on a satisfactory long-term answer to how the cross-strait relationship should be managed. So both sides, especially now, have a very different view, not only of what the status quo is, but what the agreements that we've made should be and how they should be interpreted. And so, unfortunately, I think that puts us in a very difficult position moving forward.
You mentioned some of the agreements that dictate U.S.-China relations and China-Taiwan relations today. And, you know, on the American side, the United States officially has a policy of what we call strategic ambiguity. And it's buttressed by the agreements you mentioned and domestic legislation like the Taiwan Relations Act. What does this mean? What does strategic ambiguity mean? And how has the United States carried out this policy in practice?
Well, you know, in fact, strategic ambiguity itself is a little bit ambiguous, unfortunately. But I think the clearest way of thinking about this is that, you know, if you go back to that period in the early Cold War, so shortly after 1949, it turns out that both sides, both China and Taiwan, the People's Republic of China and the Republic of China, were intent on invading the other. And so the U.S. intervened. It sent the Seventh Fleet to prevent either side from crossing the strait. And so the early portion of the U.S.-Republic of China relationship, when the U.S. had a mutual defense treaty, it wasn't just about stopping the communist Chinese from invading Taiwan. It was also about stopping Chiang Kai-shek and his nationalists from trying to recover what they had lost, right? Basically land back on the mainland and try and take control of mainland China again. And so the U.S. policy of strategic ambiguity in some ways is still about this concept of dual deterrence. Now that's very different than it was back in the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s. Now what that really means is that the U.S. is both trying to deter China from launching an invasion or some other kind of military campaign across the Taiwan Strait, but it's also trying to deter the political authorities in Taiwan from formally declaring independence or doing something similar to that that might trigger a large conflict. Now, the logic is that strategic ambiguity can do both of those things. It can be enough of a deterrent to China, but also not too much of a blank check to the authorities in Taiwan that they might effectively declare independence or a referendum or something of that sort. I think that the challenge today, however, is that a lot of people are asking if this is really the right policy anymore, because the dynamic, the dual deterrence dynamic, has changed. China certainly seems much more threatening in terms of its cross-strait approach. And I think Taipei seems less likely to do particularly risky things. And so a lot of people are pushing for the U.S. to redefine this ambiguous approach. And instead of saying, as we do now, that it's not entirely clear what the United States would do if China attempted to invade or otherwise coerce Taiwan, that, you know, some people want the United States to just go ahead and say that the U.S. would directly intervene in a conflict. And that, I think, is the root of the challenge around the logic of strategic ambiguity. And it's something that is being pretty hotly debated. And as you guys know, the president, in fact, himself has weighed in a couple of times and perhaps undermined the policy through those statements.
I wanted to get to, you know, the president, President Biden's statements. You know, as you said, this wasn't, there was a, 60 Minutes interview that just aired, I believe, on this past Sunday. And, you know, this really wasn't the first time that he committed to American troops, or at least U.S. forces coming to the defense of Taiwan. He also said that the question of Taiwan independence is a decision that the Taiwanese will make for themselves. Do these statements mark a departure from standing U.S. policy, or how can we take understand the president's advisor statements that the President Biden's statements do not mark a shift from existing U.S. policy? And if so, how are we comporting the president's statements with the claims that U.S. policy, of be it strategic ambiguity, dual deterrence, that those remain unchanged?
Yeah, these are great questions. So the president has now said four times he's made comments about Taiwan that don't seem to really equate to existing U.S. policy. And I think you're exactly right. He is eroding strategic ambiguity. He's making it more clear that the United States would come to Taiwan's aid. I think of strategic ambiguity on a spectrum. You know, the less ambiguous China is about the threats it's making to Taiwan, the less ambiguous the United States will be in response about its strategic response. So I think what you're hearing from Biden is it's probably shifting a little bit on that spectrum. It's not abandoning strategic ambiguity entirely, because Biden may say that he's going to intervene, but he's not telling you exactly how he would intervene or exactly in which cases. He's not describing any of this very clearly, but he's definitely saying more clearly that his intention would be to send U.S. military assistance and U.S. troops to support Taiwan. I think the other comment you mentioned, however, which Biden has made several times in different fora, is probably more out of line with U.S. policy. I don't think you'll hear the administration reinforce this idea that Biden said that, you know, sort of Taiwan can declare independence and that that is up to the authorities in Taiwan to do. I think that is out of line with the administration's broader approach. And so my guess is that the administration is going to walk those kinds of comments back pretty consistently. My personal view is that Biden is not actually trying to change U.S. policy. He just can't quite remember exactly what these policies are. And let's be very honest, even a lot of people who are Asia experts can't remember exactly what U.S. policy is in terms of cross-strait relations because it is incredibly complex. So I wish the president could remember this well, but he's not the only one that has made mistakes in this regard. And unfortunately, I think he's going to keep making mistakes. So I think the administration is really in a position now where rather than letting the president come out, make some mistakes in public about how he talks about these issues and then have to clean it up later, they would be much better off actually just giving a major speech by Jake Sullivan or Tony Blinken explaining what their policy is on Taiwan, and then they won't have to do the cleanup whenever the president makes a mistake in the future.
How is China responding to, you know, what you describe as mistakes by President Biden, but, you know, mistakes that, you know, like you also said, happened, you know, four times now? And, you know, I want to refer to a survey by the Center for Strategic International Studies, where it surveyed experts, including, you know, you, Dr. Cooper, that showed a unanimous agreement among China experts in the United States that China expects the U.S. military would deploy forces to defend Taiwan from an invasion. So why then does the president's statements matter? And, you know, China may be expressing, you know, indignment against these statements, but does China, you know, genuinely care about what President Biden is saying in this case? Or are they just perceiving it simply as a mistake by a president?
Yeah, so I think my view on this is that most government officials that I talk to from China and most experts are quite convinced that Biden's statements are intentional in that they are pre-planned, not just by him, but by members of his team. I am quite convinced that that is incorrect, but I will tell you, having tried to convince my Chinese colleagues that they're wrong about this, it doesn't go very well. And I can understand why. The logic, if this were intentional, is pretty clear. It's sending a strong signal to China. It is hard for the Chinese to react to because it just appears to be an off-the-cuff remark. And yet it's sending a very strong signal and is shifting policy in a bit, but in a way that's hard for China to respond to. So I understand why the Chinese think this is pre-planned. I am very convinced that it is not. But I think, you know, in some ways that means it's having the deterrent effect because the authorities in Beijing appear to believe that, you know, this is a policy change, and so they should be a bit more deterred than they were previously. On the other hand, I think then having the White House repeatedly walk back these statements is probably not helpful. It sort of weakens the message that Biden is sending, and at this point, it's pretty clear that this is his view. So I don't know why we bother then to walk this back. But the other point I would make is that I think for the Chinese, I don't know that they assume the U.S. would intervene. In fact, The CSIS poll that you mentioned, I think, is really good, and it raises a lot of fascinating questions. One of the questions they asked was whether experts in the U.S. thought that this administration would intervene to support Taiwan in a crisis. And you're exactly right. All of us thought that they would. Now, I don't believe that that's the Chinese view. I actually think that a lot of Chinese experts, and certainly some officials as well, believe that this is just bluffing on behalf of the U.S. and on behalf of the president and his administration. And so I think this disagreement about the likelihood of U.S. interaction in support of Taiwan is really dangerous. And this is maybe the area that I'm most worried about, because, you know, any scholar of international relations knows that one of the most dangerous periods is when you've got one side misperceiving the other. And I think here there's some risk that the Chinese side perceives the U.S. as not committed to Taiwan, when in fact the U.S. is quite committed to helping Taiwan. And so I think this is one of the things that the administration is going to have to try and manage over the next couple of years.
And Dr. Cooper, I think this is a great segue to what I wanted to talk about next, which is how are things looking from China's side? And from my knowledge base, I know that classified war games have been used by the Pentagon, are still being used to assess potential outcomes for conflict, including one over Taiwan. But I also know that you yourself, Dr. Cooper, have participated recently in one that was public, or the results were made public, and it was hosted by CSIS, and it showed that the U.S. and Taiwan could defend Taiwan against a potential Chinese attack. And when I read about this, I thought this was super interesting, and I wanted to ask you, during this exercise, what were some potential invasion strategies that were considered, and what were some of China's potential weaknesses that that you guys calculated?
Well, I think one of the real challenges with simulations and war games in general is that, you know, a lot of people approach these kind of like as if they were real scientific tests. And the reality is that usually the way you build a war game determines the outcomes. Maybe not 100%, but maybe 80 or 90%. So, you know, I could build you two different war games that look pretty similar, but which I know will give two completely different outcomes. You know, I could build one that ends in China losing the war and one in with China succeeding on an invasion. And I think one of the real confusing parts of wargaming as a result is that people often say that, you know, the U.S. has done lots of wargaming on China and it loses every single time. Of course, my view is, most of the time, the war games they're talking about, they're run by the Defense Department. And I've run some of these war games. You don't run a war game to find out that you're just going to easily win a war. You run it to try and show that there are things that could lead to you losing the war, and therefore you might need to do certain things differently, and to build support for doing some difficult bureaucratic or institutional changes to try and do better in a future conflict. So, you know, if we're talking about DoD war games, then you might expect that we would lose maybe not all of them, but certainly a lot, because they're supposed to be learning efforts. And I think, you know, in the same vein, there's been some concern that maybe therefore the war game results are too negative for the U.S. And so I've done some games also run by others where, in fact, you know, the highlight is not necessarily just the problems for the U.S. or for Taiwan, but also some of the constraints that China has. And in that regard, I think the most obvious constraint for China is that there are many possible Taiwan scenarios. You could think about a blockade. You could think about seizure of an outlying island. You could think about a missile barrage. But if you're talking about a full-scale invasion, China has to land huge numbers of troops. It has to be able to fight in very mountainous, difficult territory. It has to be able to resupply those forces. and to do that all potentially while facing, you know, the world's top military and the third largest economy in the world, potentially in Japan, and Taiwan, which has been preparing for an invasion for 70 years. So in my view, the biggest challenge for China is really how to protect the amphibious ships that would transport those troops across, that would also be needed to provide the lift that would actually give them not just the troops, but the logistical support. And those ships have to go from a couple of ports in China to a couple of landing spots in Taiwan. And that is a huge vulnerability for China. And these are large vessels. They're easy to see. And so if the U.S. or Taiwan can sink enough of those ships early enough in a conflict, they can make an invasion very difficult for China. And that's sometimes the big challenge that the Chinese military runs into in these kinds of simulations.
And I wanted to thank you so much for clarifying that point about wargaming. I know, including myself, a lot of us don't really maybe understand some of the the conclusions that should be drawn from a particular war game. And so I did see also a lot of newspapers or a lot of news articles saying afterwards that based on the results of the game, maybe China's not ready or they don't have the capabilities to launch a successful invasion. So is that a conclusion that can be drawn from what happened a few months ago? Or a better question is, what might China need now in order to better achieve its objectives?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. So my view is that we're never really going to know for sure if China is capable of taking Taiwan, because so much of this is contingent. And, you know, a good example of this is I was debating Russia's invasion of Ukraine with some Russia experts recently, and some of them were arguing that, you know, it looks now, if you look back, like Russia's invasion was just this huge failure. But in fact, in the early days, things came quite close to going very differently. And it is certainly possible that the Ukrainian military and the political system could have fallen in the first few days if some relatively small aspects of the invasion had gone differently and if chance had worked out differently. And I think that's the same thing in the case of China potentially invading Taiwan. So I don't think we can use war games to tell us, you know, for sure whether a country is capable or not capable of doing something. I do think they tend to lead to good questions to ask. So, you know, in China's case, how capable is China of putting enough amphibious vessels across the Taiwan Strait and protecting those vessels? How capable is Taiwan or the United States of sinking those amphibious ships? I think those kinds of questions, war games can really help isolate and raise to the fore. But I think no one is going to be confident about what China is capable of doing on Taiwan without actually being in a major conflict, unfortunately. There's just too much chance in these things. So I think the war games, they can give you sort of a sense of the rough likelihood of this working, but we should remember that, you know, there's a huge amount of chance involved, especially when you have a military like China's that hasn't fought a major conflict since 1979. And so, you know, they have a lot of new equipment, but basically no one in their military has ever really fought a major war. And so everything could work pretty well, or they could run into huge problems as the Russians have in Ukraine. And I just don't think we're going to be able to be confident about that before a conflict happens. But this is part of what is so risky. Therefore, you know, hopefully, in an ideal scenario, the U.S. and Taiwan and China all have the same view of the likelihood of a conflict and who would prevail. The danger is if China thinks that it can prevail, the U.S. and Taiwan think that China cannot, That I think is a real dangerous period, and I worry a little bit that that might be what we're heading into, that Xi Jinping might be overconfident in his capabilities, and that is classically, you know, a recipe for a major conflict.
And with China investing more on their military and the U.S. sending some sums of money to the ongoing invasion in Ukraine, I think some of our listeners might be wondering, is the United States making sufficient investments to its forces in Asia to prepare for the defense of Taiwan? Is that a fair question to be wondering?
Yeah, and my answer would be no. Mm-hmm. I think the U.S. has talked a big game in Asia for 10 or 20 years. And actually, it just hasn't done nearly as much as you would have expected for the amount of talk. And so my personal view is it's really time for the U.S. to get much more serious about this. We should be much more serious about providing Taiwan the kinds of capabilities that it needs to really pose a military challenge to China. We should be putting some substantial pressure on Taiwan to invest in the kinds of capabilities that we think are critical. We should be working with Taiwan to make sure that our militaries have a shared understanding of how a conflict might happen and what their respective roles would be. And we have to bolster the capabilities of the U.S. military in the region. So there's a lot of work to do. And I think that question is entirely fair. And, you know, unfortunately, if you go back in the history of U.S. strategy in Asia, just even the last decade, you know, you have Obama's rebalance to Asia. You have Trump calling China a strategic competitor. You have Biden really focusing a lot of his foreign policy around China. But you would have thought we would have made some major military changes as a result of those strategic evolutions, and we just haven't. So I think it is absolutely time to make some really substantial changes in that regard.
What does those additional investments, what should they look like? Is it in terms of just investing greater, you know, personnel to the region, to U.S. bases in, say, Okinawa? Or does it involve, you know, sending more aid to U.S. allies and partners like, you know, Philippines down in Southeast Asia, Korea, or Japan?
Yeah, I think it's sort of all of the above. My view is we should be doing a lot of work with Japan in particular. Japan is, you know, really close to Taiwan. People forget this because if you look on a map, the main islands of Japan are not that close to Taiwan. But Japan's southwestern islands go basically all the way down towards Taiwan. And in fact, one of those islands is closer to Taiwan than Taiwan is to China. So I think it's really hard to imagine a major China-Taiwan contingency in which the U.S. gets involved, but Japan does not. So I think there has to be a lot of coordination between the U.S. and Japan about a Taiwan scenario. There should be quietly a lot of coordination between the U.S. and Taiwan, both to bolster their militaries, but also to make sure that we understand how to work carefully with them and what our roles would be. And then there's some unilateral things that the U.S. should be doing with its own military to make sure that it can, in particular, strike naval vessels that are trying to cross the strait. I think at the end of the day, China can't do this all with missiles and aircraft. It has to do it with ships. And, you know, ships are big, they're relatively slow moving, and they are hard to defend if you have the right capabilities. So I think a lot of investment by the U.S. in things like anti-ship missiles is going to be really critical.
So far in our discussion, we've really just focused on the likelihood of an outright invasion of Taiwan by China. But China has also demonstrated, you know, a fair amount of success in employing gray zone tactics that, you know, go shy of an outright conflict, or, you know, salami, what people say, salami slice tactics, where they slowly erode at existing status quo order. And, you know, you see that in their actions in the South China Sea in terms of the Paracel Islands. But I'm wondering, how likely is China able to take control of Taiwan by using these tactics instead of an outright war? And are the requirements to prepare for China employing such tactics different than what preparations might look like for an outright war?
It's a really important question. And my view is that at the end of the day, Xi Jinping is going to use all the tools at his disposal. And, you know, as you note, an invasion might not be the best tool for several objectives. Of course, if he really wants to physically take control of Taiwan, then really the only way to do that is to actually invade and invade successfully. But he may have a lot of objectives up to that point that don't require an invasion. So perhaps he wants to get political leaders in Taiwan to stop saying something that he thinks is too pro-independence, or to convince American leaders to back off of support for Taiwan. In those kinds of cases, I think you can imagine Xi Jinping doing a whole variety of things, as you said, in the gray zone. And of course, you know, the Taiwanese will say that this is already happening on a daily basis. But certainly we could see, as you suggested, a blockade. We could see a missile bombardment of some sort. We could see seizure of an outlying island like the Pongus. And so I think these are all scenarios that probably get short shrift in Washington. I think they're probably more likely than people think. And so, unfortunately, you know, a lot of the energy is going into preventing China from thinking that it can invade Taiwan successfully. But in my view, if that works, what's likely to happen is not that we will see no escalation. It's that we'll drive the escalation down the escalation ladder towards these gray zone types of operations. So it might even make it more likely that we will have to deal with things like a blockade or an island seizure. And so I think we have to be preparing for all of those scenarios, and Taiwan has to be preparing for those scenarios as well.
And when we prepare for more gray zone tactics or a blockade, for example, how different is that from preparing for an outright invasion, which is what we hear more of in the discourse?
It is really different in my view. You know, if you think about an invasion, especially an amphibious invasion, we haven't seen a lot of these in recent history, but you can imagine, you know, the thousands of ships that the Allies had when they invaded Normandy. Even with all of those forces, getting off the beach was quite difficult. And the really risky point for any amphibious invasion, especially over a large body of water like the roughly 100 miles that the Chinese would have to traverse to Taiwan, is the landing ships. It's the amphibious vessels, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you have to put in potentially hundreds of thousands of people on these vessels, and you have to be able to supply them and resupply them over weeks or potentially even months. And all the while, these are big, relatively slow vessels. They are quite vulnerable. And so I think the real challenge for China in an invasion is, does it have enough amphibious vessels, and can it protect them through the early days and weeks of a conflict that can land and supply enough forces? That's the real weak point in an invasion. But, you know, if you think about a blockade, it's a totally different scenario. In that case, China might be sinking commercial ships, or certainly sinking military vessels, or threatening to do so. And the kinds of capabilities that Taiwan or the United States might need could be wholly different, right? Mm-hmm. So whereas anti-ship cruise missiles would be really effective at sinking Chinese amphibious vessels in an invasion, they might not help that much in a blockade, because you could do a blockade with submarines, right? You know, think about the Battle of the North Atlantic that we saw in World War II. And so this is one thing that I think is commonly overlooked, that simply preparing for an invasion doesn't mean that you're prepared for these gray zone scenarios. And this is something that leaders in Taiwan have been trying to remind Americans for some time. You know, if they go fully asymmetric, if they only buy missiles and mines and these sorts of things, they may be much better able to prevent an invasion, but they may not be prepared to prevent a blockade or outlying island seizure. And so I think we need to be working with Taiwan to think through all of these scenarios. We can't just fixate on the invasion option.
And when I read about deterrence and deterring a war, a lot of what the thinking that goes into that is being prepared to win a hot war if one should occur. So with the future of the international system potentially at stake in the event of a US-China conflict, is a protracted war more likely than not? And how can the US prepare to win such a war without inducing nuclear retaliation from China?
Really tough question. I think this is another area that we just don't think enough about. And for folks that are listening that are looking for thesis or dissertation topics, I think this is a perfect one. We don't talk much about war termination in general in the security studies literature. There's some good work on this, but there's not as much as you would expect, given that, you know, much of security studies is about conflict. There's so much more research about how you get into conflict and how you manage conflict once you're in it, rather than how you actually deal with ending a conflict after it has started. And so this conflict termination question is really, really difficult, especially when it comes to Taiwan. Mm-hmm. So I think most of the attention right now in Washington is on basically doing what I just talked about, how to sink enough amphibious vessels from China before they are able to land a large enough force on Taiwan and actually take the island. Mm-hmm. But let's imagine that that works, right? Let's mm-hmm. imagine that we or Taiwan get lucky. China proves unable to get a big enough force on the island to actually take it. The war doesn't stop there. And I think there's been very little thinking about what the next step is. And as you sort of suggested, you know, there's some really difficult questions related to nuclear issues. Mm-hmm. I think nuclear use is pretty hard for all of us to imagine. But if you have a nuclear power that is clearly losing a war that could lead to its legitimacy being undermined, then it's probably going to make a lot of nuclear threats. We're certainly seeing that with Vladimir Putin today. Mm-hmm. And in Xi Jinping's case, or whoever might follow him, you could certainly imagine that losing a war over Taiwan would be grounds for throwing that leader out of office. So this could be a life or death decision for top Chinese leaders. I'm not saying they would use nuclear weapons, but I'm also saying it's not something that we can ignore. And so I think this is maybe the hardest question when it comes to US-China conflict issues that is unexamined is, you know, if we fight this to a draw, and let me be clear, I think a draw is kind of good for the US, right? Because a draw means that Taiwan hasn't been taken. A draw does not mean that the conflict is over, and we are not prepared, and I think the Chinese are probably not prepared either, for a long war. We don't have the munitions. We don't have stockpiles of other kinds of supplies. We don't have the industrial base to be able to build back what we've lost. We're seeing this now with Ukraine. So, we talk a lot about the dangers of protracted war, the importance of conflict termination. But in my view, these are just two areas that deserve a lot more effort and thinking and work than they've gotten from the foreign policy community to date.
Right. And I guess we touched on this a little earlier, but maybe this is a moment to circle back a little bit. But with so much at stake in a potential conflict, maybe a lot of listeners or a lot of Americans are wondering, well, is Taiwan worth that big of a risk, a war with China that could risk nuclear war? Is that a rational question? And is there a way that you would respond to that?
So I think, of course, it's rational to ask, and the American people should ask, why the United States has commitments overseas, right? Mm-hmm. And I think for some of these commitments, it's easier than others, you know, where we have existing treaty allies, especially ones that we're particularly close to, whether that's a lot of our NATO allies or, you know, some of our allies in Asia. I think it's pretty clear that the American people understand why we should come to their aid, you know. Mm-hmm. If we were talking about the United Kingdom or Germany or France, Poland, Japan, Korea, Australia, I think this would be a simpler discussion.
Right.
What's hard in the Taiwan case is Taiwan is not a formal treaty ally, but it's also not like a normal partner in the sense that we have a lot more interests at stake with Taiwan than we do with most non-allied partners. And we have the Taiwan Relations Act, which does give the U.S. some responsibilities in terms of supporting Taiwan. And so I think this is something that the Biden team hasn't done well at. The Trump team didn't do well at. We haven't really explained to the American people why they should care about Taiwan. Mm-hmm. Tony Blinken was asked this question on 60 Minutes just a few days ago, and he sort of defaulted back to the point that, you know, a huge portion of the advanced semiconductors in the world are made in Taiwan. But I think that's really, you know, probably not the primary reason that we should consider going to war. I think, you know, first, there's just a basic human rights and democracy argument, which some people will buy and others will not, right? But that the idea that 23 million people should not be able to decide their future, I think is something that in general, the American people don't agree with. You see that with Ukraine, you hear that with Taiwan. So I think that's one issue. A second is, as Blinken said, the semiconductors and the fact that Taiwan is something like the number 9 trading partner of the United States. It's the source of a huge portion of the advanced semiconductors. So there would be tremendous economic downsides. And then Caitlin Talmadge and others at Georgetown have made the argument that there's also a strategic rationale that if Taiwan were to be held by China, it becomes much more difficult for the U.S. to defend treaty allies like Japan and the Philippines. So, you know, I think those are sort of the three clearest logics for the U.S. intervening. There's some people who will say, well, this is all about American primacy and the United States not wanting to give up dominance militarily. I think that's a bad reason in general to go to war. So I think we have to rest on some much more carefully specified arguments. And we have to convince the American people that these things are worth potentially risking American blood and treasure for.
Dr. Cooper, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It was a pleasure having you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. We hope you enjoyed it. We would like to say thank you to the International Studies Program at Johns Hopkins University and the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University for making this episode possible. Remember to follow us on social media at Hopkins POFA on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for the latest and greatest of Hopkins POFA content. Hit follow on Spotify, subscribe on iTunes, and leave a rating. We'll see you next time.